From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, those Friday night into Saturday morning open lines, here's what's happening. What a very strange story this is. A knife found buried under O.J. Simpson's former Los Angeles estate where he lived at the time of the murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman is undergoing forensic testing as we speak. A construction worker found the knife apparently years ago and gave it to an off-duty cop who kept it in his home before finally turning it over to police in January. Now, he tells everybody that he told the police that he had that knife a long time ago. Who knows? The home was demolished in 1998. It is being treated as they would all evidence, according to a captain at the Los Angeles Police Department. Simpson's property was in the Brentwood section of Los Angeles in 1995. A jury found him not guilty of murder after the so-called trial of the century dominated the media for months. Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman, her friend, were found stabbed to death in June of 1994. Now, in 1997, a jury found Simpson civilly liable for the slayings, and now he's imprisoned in Nevada on an unrelated robbery-kidnap conviction. The weapon used in the killings has been a mystery for decades. By the way, they cannot retry him for the murders. Former neurosurgeon Ben Carson dropped out of the 2016 presidential race Friday after declaring there was no political path forward for his campaign. In a speech at the Conservative Political Action Conference in Maryland, he simply said, "I am leaving the campaign trail," but promised that he would remain heavily involved in saving our nation. A handful of delegates for the Democrats and the Republicans coming up on Saturday for several more primaries. Joey Feek, who rose to fame as a member of the soulful husband and wife country duo, Joey and Rory, she's died. She was 40 years old. She had cervical cancer that eventually spread to her colon. She was a very good singer. A Zika vaccine could be ready for human trials later this year, according to the man in charge of the U.S. government's research program, Dr. Anthony Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, hopes to start testing a DNA vaccine by September. About 100 Americans so far have been diagnosed with Zika after returning from affected countries. Zika, of course, strongly suspected link between the virus and babies with underdeveloped brains. And health officials are testing water, skin care products, and over-the-counter medications and interviewing patients and families trying to identify the source of an outbreak of a bacteria that has sickened 44 people in southern Wisconsin and may have contributed to 18 deaths. Now, what's this all about? Let's check in with Dr. Gary Ridenour, author of Pandemic. Gary, what do we know about this one?
Well, first off, this outbreak is the first time this outbreak has happened in the world, and nature always finds a way. And Elizabeth King identified the bacteria in 1960. 2003, the Mir station found a similar bacteria growing in their spaceship. And they were compared, and they were relatives. And there's only about 5 cases on the planet per year, but near Madison, Wisconsin, there's 11 counties that have reported the 44 cases. And clinical signs are shortness of breath, chills, and fever, which can be confused with just the flu. And this bacteria is all over the planet. It lives in frogs and fish, and nobody's been paying attention to it until now. Most of the Wisconsin cases are people over the age of 65 or older. And the bacteria is hard to treat. It's resistant to antibiotics. And the CDC says it's not contagious. So I was wondering, maybe it's that good cheese they have there in Wisconsin.
Who knows? I hope it's not the Andromeda strain coming from some craft or some comet or something spilling to the planet. What do you think, Gary?
Or from the Mir station. I mean, the Mir bacteria has now been reported in 5 cases on the planet. So The Muir bacteria is also beginning to infect people.
That came down a long, long time ago, didn't it?
Yeah, no, they found it growing on the window of the spaceship.
Unbelievable. Okay, Gary, thanks. Keep in touch. The United States added 242,000 jobs in February, a healthy number, easily exceeding analysts' expectations. Some say, hey, this might help ease concerns that the economy is falling back into a recession. I'm not so sure about that. SpaceX has another launch under its belt, but not another rocket landing. The leftover first stage booster hit the floating platform very hard on Friday. SpaceX scored a rocket landing at the ground at Cape Canaveral in December, but has yet to nail a trickier barge landing at sea. They got to still work on that. And what else is going on in the skies these days? Let's check in with Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center for his weekly report. Peter, what's going on this week?
Well, greetings from Eastern Washington, George.
Hello, sir.
It's been quite a week. Boy, some fascinating reports, most of which we've posted to our website tonight, but a couple past reports from past decades, and then a few more current reports from just last week, and in fact from last night. But two past reports, one from 1965, just came in yesterday, a story of a couple who were in Littleton, Colorado, in Daniels Park. I presume the people there are familiar with that park. About late June of 1965, they were out on a picnic, and they finished their picnic. They walked over to the edge of a ravine, and they were looking into the ravine. They saw three disc-shaped craft streak across the sky and stop in midair, not too far from them. This didn't concern them too much until about 4 minutes later, they estimate. One of those craft dropped to the ground, and a second one started approaching their position. Well, this got their attention. They started running for their car, and before they knew it, that disc was directly above their car, George. It's quite a story, and I recommend people read the rest of the story because it's as chilling as the first part. About 13 years later, this takes us to August of 1978, the city of Santa Clarita, used to be called Valencia. You probably know where it is, just north of San Fernando Valley. About August of 1978, a gentleman was cleaning out his swimming pool. His kids were going to be swimming the next morning, he writes. Wanted to have it cleaned up for them. And he looked up and was just on the verge of terror to see a disc approaching him across his neighborhood. He called for his wife. They stood there and looked at this disc. He said the width of it was about the equivalent length of a Greyhound bus. As the object hovered there for, he estimates, about 45 seconds, it suddenly tipped toward them, and that's when he could see that there was a huge plate glass. He calls it a window in the bottom side of this craft, and he said it was one of the most unusual things he's ever seen. He could see blue light on the inside of the craft. Very interesting report. I commend it to listeners' attention because if it's true and it has all the hallmarks of being a legitimate report, it's a very stunning sighting, and we have a very nice illustration on our homepage that the witness provided together with his written report. A little closer to home, last week, Friday, the 26th of February, at about 50 minutes past midnight, a gentleman and his wife up in Vancouver, B.C., were sitting on their porch of their apartment, and they suddenly, their attention was drawn to a huge gray object that was floating across that city, George, going from north to south. Not a light on it, they report. Very, very interesting report. The gentleman had a very high-quality pair of binoculars, Celestron 15 by 70s. Most people who look at the night sky knows what those are. And he got a very good look at it. He said there appeared to be dust on the surface of it. It was close enough to him so he could see individual qualities of the surface of that craft. The next night, Bethesda, Maryland, just briefly, there was a very bright flash and an immense explosion. I'm hearing about those explosions regularly now. Very close to the National Institute of Health building, the woman who submitted the report said she thought the building had been bombed, and yet there were no emergency vehicles that followed up.
Oh, boy.
Very strange. Next night, Centerville, Virginia, three adults in a hot tub saw the formation.
Sure they did.
And they claimed they had not been drinking. And finally, just last night, George, very, very dramatic sighting in central Vermont. I think it's west Topsham. This is just southeast of Montpelier and Barrie, Vermont. A family was treated to about 5 minutes of the most terrifying, most dramatic sighting of these orange lights that I'm aware of. They were going in all directions. In one instance, two of them were observed to suddenly join and become very large. And it was all accompanied by a very distinct growling sound.
Jeez.
like a snowplow on a rough road. And just in closing, let me say I have not failed to observe that the sighting occurred and the growling occurred in Vermont just about the same time that the growling was occurring in Detroit at the political debate. So that's what's going on, and I commend to people's attention those new reports on our website. Just the ones on our homepage are really, really interesting.
I love it. Peter, thank you. I look forward to your reports every Friday, sometimes Thursday as well. Up next, communing with the ancestors, your spirit guides, bloodline allies, and the cycle of reincarnation. Raven Grimassi is back with us, a practicing witch, next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast AM. I'm looking forward to this night. Raven Grimassi back with us, of course, practicing witch, award-winning author, more than 20 books out there on witchcraft, Wicca, magic, and inner mysteries traditions. Now he brings to the table more than 40 years of personal experience, studying in-depth understanding of all these fields. He's a popular lecturer and presenter all around the country, and he's back on Coast to Coast. Raven, looking forward to this night.
Thank you. I am as well. Thanks for having me back.
What's new with you?
Oh, always got a project going. I just finished a book called Communing with the Ancestors, as you know, and that's kind of my focus now, promoting that and getting the message out to everyone about that whole theme.
How did Raven Grimassi become a witch?
Well, that is an interesting story. It's kind of in the old family bloodline.
Mm-hmm.
My mother was born and raised in Italy, and she brought with her an old tradition, what I call peasant witchcraft. And that's how I cut my teeth. But later on in my teens, I got involved in Wicca. And then through that, you know, met all different people, different traditions, and got deeply involved in other forms of witchcraft beyond the Italian. The Italian was my home for quite a while, but now I'm sort of what I call non-cultural. I look at the commonalities of witchcraft throughout our European ancestors now.
Raven, did you get misunderstood in your earlier days as a witch? Did people think, oh my God, this guy's evil, he's a devil worshiper, run!
Well, there's certainly, I mean, that certainly still happens. There are misconceptions, and that's a tricky word when you say witch. You know, back in the 60s, we displaced it with the word Wiccan.
Yeah.
Because it gave you a moment to explain. You know, the door didn't close instantly when someone said, oh, you know, what religion you practice? You said Wicca. They go, oh, what's that? Whereas if you were to say, oh, a witchcraft, then they, you know, like you said, the doors would slam, the person take off running. It's a maligned word, unfortunately, and there's a whole history behind that.
And, of course, the late 1600s, if you said witch, you'd be burned at the stake, or God knows what they'd do to you.
Yeah, those were the dark times.
Those people back in the 1600s, 1692, I think, is when those trials began. What did they do to really get chastised the way they did and, you know, executed? What did they do, Raven?
Well, it didn't take much, you know, and we do have to remember that the vast majority of people who were executed as witches were not in any way involved in witchcraft. There's so much politics involved with it, but basically there's two factors. There's human nature, you know, where people dislike other people. you got some strange lady living on the outskirts of town that no one really likes, and they're suspicious of her. And there were things you could gain by turning someone in as a witch. You would actually inherit their property. And so there were incentives to turn people in. Any erratic behavior would certainly, you know, end you up in court if you were kind of different.
Yeah.
Spent a lot of time in the woods, you know, people would see you out there wondering what you were doing. If they saw you sort of talking to yourself, you know, these are the things that people would say, oh, that's a witch. And then the church also found it beneficial to have kind of a scapegoat, especially when things were not going well in the villages, food shortages, illnesses, lots of trouble. We know from anthropological studies we know from these studies that these people were the scapegoats, because if you could get rid of that person, then the magistrate or the church would say, okay, now the witch is gone and you'll be okay now. The danger is over.
Right.
So there were advantages to having one individual become kind of that personification of trouble or evil and then get rid of them, and it made everyone feel better.
And Hollywood Raven surely didn't help being a witch either. Because, you know, you think of the Wizard of Oz, you think primarily of the Wicked Witch, and Hollywood kind of tainted that, didn't it?
Well, you know, that was good and bad. You know, there were definitely some very negative depictions, but then also, you know, we sort of started climbing out of that with, Elizabeth Montgomery and Bewitched, you know, the beautiful witch has come back, you know, all the magical themes, I Dream of Jeannie and all these things, you know, these old shows back then. It started to change it back to sort of the Victorian age, when witches were, if you look at the drawings from that, the witches actually are quite lovely. It's the earlier drawings in which they're, you know, they're not.
Warts on their nose and everything else.
Yeah, you know, the whole depiction of the green skin and the matted hair and the broken teeth, you know, that has a long history of malignment.
There are, you know, good people, bad people. There are good cops, there are bad cops. I assume there are good witches, there are bad witches, aren't there?
Yeah, certainly. And like you said, it's just human nature. You know, some people, they don't honor and respect the trust that's been given to them, or they take advantage of people for personal gain and power. And unfortunately, that's true in every religion. And, you know, there are people that I know who are in what we call the craft, who aren't, the most benign of folks.
Do the witches you know do curses?
Well, it depends on what you mean by a curse. There are people in witchcraft who will use magic to protect themselves, to keep other people from harming them, or to stop some kind of behavior. And technically, those types of spells and magical works fall into binding and hexcraft. So people would say, you know, maybe it's a curse. I don't see it that way. It depends on how it's used.
Okay, now let's look at some of the new things you're working on, Raven. Of course, communing with the ancestors. Tell me about that. And who are the ancestors?
Right, exactly. Well, I think to get a running start at it, to tie witchcraft into it, although it's technically not a witchcraft book, is that the earliest themes of witches, they communicate with the dead. It shows up in ancient Greek myths. It shows up in the early writings of the church. That was actually the first allegation against witches, is that they spoke to the dead or gathered at the crossroads to speak to the dead. And that came long before the insertion of the Christian devil into witchcraft. So communing with the ancestors is really an ancient thing. And I wanted to bring about this book to teach people how to reconnect, how to hear these voices of the people who once lived in common cause with nature, when the planet was clean and balanced. And these beings still exist, and they have a vested interest in the living. So they can actually help us, and I believe eventually help turn the tide of destruction on this planet, if we all join and commune with them.
We need them to jump in really soon, Raven.
Well, they've been working. You know, it's just that people haven't been listening. And fortunately now, this is a very growing popular topic. And I think combined with some of the ecological movements and things, You know, witchcraft is all about belief, and it's all about power. And so we're not defeatists, and we think, yes, we can do this. We can turn this around.
Well, let's talk more about this in your latest work, Communing with the Ancestors. We'll be back. And our special guest tonight, Raven Grimasi, as we talk about his latest work, Communing with the Ancestors. Lots to talk with him about that. And we'll take phone calls with him next hour here on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast, Raven Grimasi with us. Raven, as we talk about the ancestors, were they people that died? Is that who they are?
Yeah, they are the people that came before us from the very beginning, the beginning of when something could be called human, I suppose. And we are the direct descendants of those in an unbroken line. The only reason, like, you and I are here is because every one of our ancestors lived long enough to reproduce.
Exactly.
So you and I literally are the living stewards of an entire lineage from the very beginning.
Part of your headline in your book, title, is The Cycle of Reincarnation. How does that fit into this?
Right. It's an interesting idea because some people say, well, you know, if your ancestors are still around, then who's reincarnating, you know? How do you reincarnate if you remain an ancestor? And there's a lot of confusion about what that whole process is about. It's not really the ancestors that are reincarnating. It's the souls that inhabit the bodies that are provided by our ancestors, the ones you and I are wearing now. So the idea of reincarnation is a cycle in which let me put it to you this way. Every human has a goal or a desire or something they want to accomplish in a lifetime. So does our lineage. So does our heritage. So there is an ancestral line that wants to fulfill a mission. And so that line is used by the ancestors to draw souls into the bodies that animate our bodies. And the soul is here to learn education through a material existence. But by inhabiting the body, the ancestors also benefit by allowing their lineage to continue through time unbroken. So that's really sort of how reincarnation factors in with the ancestors.
Is this something that anybody should be frightened about or concerned about?
No, not at all, because, I mean, this is our makeup. This is very natural. This is what our ancestors understood when they lived in common cause with nature and the world. Within us, we have DNA, and that DNA is the memory of our ancestors. We look like our ancestors because of this DNA. And DNA has memory in it. Science is now beginning to find out that there's actually memory within the DNA of people in your lineage behind you. So there's nothing scary. It's both metaphysics and science. It is just a understanding of our being in a more expanded way. For far too long, I think religions have contained and constrained us to really finite modes of thinking. And in order to fix the things around us and restore the balance, we need to regain an expanded view. And so we kind of need the ancestors to remind us of our lineage, our heritage, and what we're here to do.
What if we come from a lineage of negative people?
Right.
I mean, because some people do.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Some people have ancestors who were rather nasty.
Yep.
This is what we call redeeming the ancestors. It's a popular work right now among many people in metaphysics. The idea that our ancestors are bound by their deeds, and some of them are held in a very negative spot because of what they did. And so we can, through ritual and through offerings, because we are the living current steward of our bloodline, we can claim that as a sort of an authoritative or noble position and turn around and then say to our ancestors who were the negative ones, I redeem you by the blood that you and I shared, and I, as the steward of this lineage bloodline, release you from that contamination of your deeds. Another word would be forgive you or pardon you. And it's one way to begin to let that energy detach itself from our ancestors. Because as long as it's there, it's like a log jam in a river. We need to clean that out so the ancestral flow to us is pure and clean. That's when communication with the ancestors becomes strongest.
How do you reach them?
Well, there's simple techniques. It's really, there's things you build upon. But to start with, it's kind of like the idea, you know, if you look at a priest in a church, that priest will go to an altar, which is a physical place, you know, and there meet with God and you know, so to speak, through the altar, the sacred center. So with the ancestors, we do the same. We start out with a shrine or an altar to our ancestors. We put things on the altar that represent our heritage, our lineage. So you might put symbols. If you're Celtic, there'd be a Celtic symbol. If you're Italian, there'd be Italian symbols. A lot of us have other nationalities within us. So you'd represent your nationality on the altar. Then you'd look at the foods that were common to the cultures that our ancestors came from. So you'd set food offerings from them. This is classic and very ancient. And then you would light candles and some incense, do some deep breathing, get real centered and quiet, and then call through your blood, literally. Call down through your blood and ask the ancestors to connect with you, to communicate with you, and to be present. And that's how the process begins.
When they connect, how do you know that?
It's an inner knowing. I mean, that's an interesting word. It's an inner knowing. You feel it. There's a shift. And then all of a sudden, you find yourself guided to things without you being conscious of it. Like, you may be somewhere, you've been thinking about a certain thing that's popping into your mind, and you're wondering about it. And then one day, you find yourself at the mall, and in the store window, you see an image of it, or you're in a bookstore, and all of a sudden, you see a title on the shelf. And you weren't intending that, but all of a sudden there it is. The ancestors keep putting these visual things in front of you, leading you to where you need to be.
Great moments of synchronicity, I guess.
Absolutely.
The ability to tap into this, do you see them at all or physically hear them, or do you hear them in your head?
Well, that depends on the person and how much they work with the ancestors. And then there's the dead also, who are different from the ancestors, and that's where people get confused as well.
Right. And that's where some evil could come
from. Dead, then we'll see their ancestors.
They will.
Yes.
And the dead, some of them may not be friendly.
Well, people are people, and I always say, if you're, Aunt Agnes was nasty in life, she's going to be nasty in death, It doesn't change. So there are some spirits that don't have the best intentions and who are kind of angry or maybe jealous or resentful. Those energies can certainly keep them here and can certainly make them problematic for us. Most of the spirits that cross over are just, they're just normal. They eventually pass. They don't have a reason to stay behind, and they're not problematic.
Raven, by communing with the ancestors, what's the goal here? What are we trying to accomplish?
Well, we're trying to get rebooted. We're trying to stand upon the shoulders of those who came before us and see with greater vision and clarity so that we can start to bring reason back to the way we live on this planet. Our ancestors understood that if you take from the earth, you must give back. They understood that you must live in harmony and balance with it. If all you do is take, you will deplete it.
Mm-hmm.
So the ancestors remind us that the earth is not a resource, that the earth is a companion and an ally. And the more that the ancestors can direct us in ways of honoring and respecting and preserving the earth, the human race will be around for a very long time. If we don't listen to the words of the ancestors and we just allow things to continue the way they are, then this will one day be a barren planet.
Will they ever strike back to fight things that may not be going the right way? Will they step in, for example, if there are two warring nations? Do they do things in very mystical ways
Well, they're always
themselves.
Influencing us. They don't have the intervention as one would think, like some, classical god, coming down and changing something. But they work on individuals, and they try to find vessels people and place them into situations of personal, political power, literary power, entertainment. You know, they try to amplify the message through these individuals. So it's not that they can intervene and stop something, but they could certainly influence. And one of the problems we find in certain parts of the world, some of these wars are ancestral. These people are fighting ancient wars that they never put an end to. And they have hatred of this tribe and that tribe. And this is where the ancestors find it very difficult to communicate, if you're locked into that. So we have to return to the spirituality, back to the ancestral shrine, and listen to the spiritual message that can redeem us.
Now, when you talk about reincarnation, mm-hmm. and we're dealing with the ancestors, what if we're right in the middle of dealing with one and poof, off they go, they get reincarnated?
Well, again, it's not that the ancestors are reincarnating. The soul is reincarnating. Okay. We have to, in the book I talk about us having three bodies. We have the physical body, we have the human consciousness body, and then we have the soul. The soul is what reincarnates. The body dies and returns back to the basic elements. The human consciousness becomes the dead. And the dead will eventually no longer be the dead. They will be absorbed into the ancestral realm and what I call the hive mentality. So it's really our souls that reincarnate, not our personalities.
Okay. All right. So basically you have this ability to separate.
Separation is natural, yes. Once the body dies, it can no longer hold the three forms together.
Do you believe in hell?
No, I don't. I believe that there are energies that need redeeming and resolution. I don't believe you can live a horrible life harming people and just being a very vile individual, die and everything's okay. I think there is something you will have to resolve in some dimension or in some form. But I certainly do not believe in any eternal punishment or hellfire or consignment to some realm of eternal torment. I think that's kind of an evil teaching.
Witches, Wiccan, they believe in God. They believe in a male-female God, but they believe in God, right?
Well, they believe in a divine source, and that divine source they will label a goddess or a god or both.
With this divine source, it's probably every religion, believing in the same source. They just fight about it all the time.
Yeah, because we give it names and images, and then we don't like the ones the other people have. And, humans can be very petty. Unfortunately, divinity is not petty, and I don't believe it cares what name you call it as long as you call it, So I think we're the problem, not the gods, but yeah.
Let's talk about witchcraft for a moment, Raven, as it applies to individuals who want a better job, a better life, a better relationship. They want something like that. Can you do things like that? Can you practice witchcraft to better things for yourself?
Certainly. And witchcraft's like anything else. So the more you put into the effort, the greater the results. And it's not unlike prayer. In some cases, people may pray for a new job or pray for a new car or whatever. It's energy. So you can enhance the energy you have and the energy around you. You can pull it in, what I call impregnate it with a thought. And that thought is the desire, I want this or that, or I need this or that. And through certain techniques, you can focus that energy, create the vision in your mind, and that becomes your goal. As long as you stay focused on it, you will draw the thing to yourself that you most desire. Now that's good and bad, because you can also draw things to you that you don't really want because you spend too much time thinking about them.
Like what? Give me an example of something you could draw to yourself that you shouldn't.
Well, for example, I'll hear people say, oh, I can't do this. I'll never have that. Every time something happens,
Cloudy, right?
What they're doing is they're drawing that energy back to themselves. They're actually asking the universe for more of that because they're spending so much time on it. Thoughts are things and you attract them. You have to have your thoughts be positive things that you want to attain, not things that you want to get rid of. The more time you spend on what you want to get rid of, the more it's going to stay with you.
How would you categorize what we call psychic vampires?
Psychic vampires.
People who have the ability to drain other people's energy
Yeah, I think there are conscious ones and I think there are unconscious ones.
I agree with that.
Yeah, I've certainly encountered people who, in their presence within a short period of time, you feel your energy going out. Some of them consciously do that. I think others, they are psychic vampires without knowing it. I think that's been known for ages, and there are magical protections. For myself, for example, I'll wear carnelian stone. And the carnelian stone is like a buffer, and I find that when I'm lecturing or teaching and I've got people focused on me, if I wear a carnelian, I'm not exhausted afterwards.
Interesting. It kind of repels any negativity?
I'm sorry?
Does it repel negativity?
It doesn't so much repel negativity as it becomes a buffer. You know, I often think of it as like an energy shield that people can tap in and still relate to you, but they can't pull at their own rate from you. You measure it out to them. They can't pull it at their own speed away from you. There are other stones and different things that witches use that, you know, can protect people from, you know, negative energy or, you know, ill will and that type of thing. But there's something for everything.
I did an interview several years ago with someone who's an expert on stones, bloodstones, all kinds of stones, and it's remarkable the different properties that they each possess, these stones.
Oh, absolutely. These are energetic forms, crystalline formations in the earth, and we know from science that crystals hold and transmit energy, and our minerals, our gems, are crystalline forms. So the shape, the color, the density, this is all going to change the resonance of these stones. And in our own culture, we favor them, you know, the diamond ring for marriage, mm-hmm. you know, the symbol of love or endurance or, you know, fidelity, you know. It's the same idea of taking something, assigning a virtue to it, and wearing it to promote that virtue.
When you are practicing witchcraft, do you do the candles yourself and, you know, chants and things like that?
Yeah, those are the gugahs, I call them, and I do like that. You know, I do like the candles and the incense and the tools. After a while, after years go by in your practice, you don't really need them.
But it's kind of nice to have them around.
I find that they enhance the environment for me. So chanting, using tools and incense, the herbs, wearing special jewelry, you know, perhaps a special robe. I think that this can really enhance and kind of get you focused on your magic.
Raven's websites are linked up at coasttocoast.com, coasttocoastam.com. It's ravengramasi.net and houseofgramasi.com. But we've got it all linked up for you. If we were to see you walking down the street, what would we see, Raven?
Depends on the season.
Aha, you're a Halloween practitioner, aren't you?
Yes. I do tend to get a little witchy looking at Halloween, but normally you couldn't tell me apart from anyone else on the street.
I mean, you'd wear jeans, a suit, whatever?
Yeah, I'm pretty casual most of the time, unless I'm at a festival or a conference or something. I'm pretty casual. The only thing you would notice encountering me is my jewelry, which was not a lot of it, but it's unusual, and you would probably wonder, you know, what that meant.
Cool. That's exciting. And for people who want to get involved in this, you know, they're on the ground level, what would you recommend?
In what, witchcraft?
Yeah.
Well, you know, there's a variety of books, and, you know, there's information and misinformation. It gets a little tricky. What I recommend is try to find some center or store or organization. You can find them on the internet that's local, and start networking with people. Get to know the people first. Feel them out. See if they're giving good or bad advice. Have them recommend a reading to you, something to read. And if you read it and like it, then you're on the right track. If you read it and don't like it, go somewhere else.
Let's check in with you. We'll talk more about this, and we'll take some phone calls, questions for Raven Gramasi, and stories, maybe your own witchcraft stories. That'll be next, and then we'll have open lines later on tonight.